through the corridors, liberated and disembodied, moving, for the moment, in pure space. The sit-down bar for women, across from the bar proper, seemed very small. It was hard to imagine what throngs it could accommodate in the afternoon. The famous Paul, the concessionaire, had not arrived. But Claude, who was checking stock, broke off his work with no improper surprise to make Abe a pick-me-up. Abe sat on a bench against a wall. After two drinks, he began to feel better. So much better that he mounted to the barber's shop and was shaved. When he returned to the bar, Paul had arrived, in his custom-built motor, from which he had disembarked correctly at the Boulevard des Capucines. Paul liked Abe and came over to talk.
"I was supposed to ship home this morning," Abe said. "I mean, yesterday morning. Or whatever this is."
"Why didn't you?" asked Paul.
Abe considered, and happened finally to a reason.
"I was reading a serial in Liberty, and the next installment was due here in Paris. So if I'd sailed, I'd have missed it. Then I never would have read it."
"It must be a very good story."
"It's a terrible story."
Paul arose chuckling and paused, leaning on the back of a chair.
"If you really want to get off, Mr. North, there are friends of yours going tomorrow on the France. Mr. What is his name? And Slim Pearson."
"Mr. I'll think of it. Tall with a new beard."
"Yardley,"
Abe supplied.
"Mr. Yardley. They're both going on the France."
He was on his way to his duties, but Abe tried to detain him.
"If I didn't have to go by way of Cherbourg, the baggage went that way."
"Get your baggage in New York," said Paul, receding.
The logic of the suggestion fitted gradually into Abe's pitch. He grew rather enthusiastic about being cared for, or rather of prolonging his state of irresponsibility. Other clients had meanwhile drifted into the bar. First came a huge Dane whom Abe had somewhere encountered. The Dane took a seat across the room, and Abe guessed he would be there all the day, drinking, lunching, talking, or reading newspapers. He felt a desire to outstay him. At 11, the college boys began to step in, stepping gingerly lest they tear one another bag from bag. It was about then he had the chasseur telephone to the divers. By the time he was in touch with them, he was in touch also with other friends. And his hunch was to put them all on different phones at once. The result was somewhat general. From time to time, his mind reverted to the fact that he ought to go over and get Freeman out of jail. But he shook off all facts as parts of the nightmare. By 1 o'clock, the bar was jammed. Amidst the consequent mixture of voices, the staff of waiters functioned, pinning down their clients to the facts of drink and money.
"That makes 2 stingers, and 1 more, 2 martinis, and 1, nothing for you, Mr. Quarterly. That makes 3 rounds. That makes 75 francs, Mr. Quarterly. Mr. Schaefer said he had this. You had the last.
I can only do what you say. Thanks very much."
In the confusion, Abe had lost his seat. Now he stood gently swaying and talking to some of the people with whom he had involved himself. A terrier ran a leash around his legs, but Abe managed to extricate himself without upsetting and became the recipient of profuse apologies. Presently, he was invited to lunch, but declined.
"It was almost Briglith," he explained. "And there was something he had to do at Briglith."
A little later, with the exquisite manners of the alcoholic that are like the manners of a prisoner or a family servant, he said goodbye to an acquaintance, and turning around, discovered that the bar's great moment was over, as precipitately as it had begun. Across from him, the Dane and his companions had ordered luncheon. Abe did likewise, but scarcely touched it. Afterwards, he just sat, happy to live in the past. The drink made past happy things contemporary with the present, as if they were still going on, contemporary, even with the future, as if they were about to happen again. At 4, the chasseur approached him.
You wish to see a colored fellow of the name Jules Peterson? God, how did he find me? I didn't tell him you were present. Who did?
Abe fell over his glasses, but recovered himself.
Says he's already been around to all the American bars and hotels. Tell him I'm not here.
As the chasseur turned away, Abe asked,
Can he come in here?
I'll find out. Receiving the question, Paul glanced over his shoulder. He shook his head. Then, seeing Abe, he came over.
I'm sorry. I can't allow it.
Abe got himself up with an effort and went out to the Rue Cambon. Chapter 24. With his miniature leather briefcase in his hand, Richard Diver walked from the 7th arrondissement, where he left a note for Maria Wallace, signed Nicole, the word with which he and Nicole had signed communications in the first days of love, to his shirtmakers, where the clerks made a fuss over him out of proportion to the money he spent. Ashamed at promising so much to these poor Englishmen, with his fine manners, his air of having the key to security, ashamed of making a tailor shift an inch of silk on his arm. Afterward, he went to the bar of the Crillon and drank a small coffee and 2 fingers of gin. As he entered the hotel, the halls had seemed unnaturally bright. When he left, he realized that it was because it had already turned dark outside. It was a windy 4 o'clock night with the leaves on the Champs-Élysées singing and failing, thin and wild. Dick turned down the Rue de Rivoli, walking 2 squares under the arcades to his bank where there was mail. Then he took a taxi and started up the Champs-Élysées through the first patter of rain, sitting alone with his love. Back at 2 o'clock in the Huajar's corridor, the beauty of Nicole had been to the beauty of Rosemary, as the beauty of Leonardo's girl was to that of the girl of an illustrator. Dick moved on through the rain, demoniac and frightened, the passions of many men inside him, and nothing simple that he could see. Rosemary opened her door full of emotions no one else knew of. She was now what is sometimes called a little wild thing. By 24 full hours, she was not yet unified, and she was absorbed in playing around with chaos, as if her destiny were a picture puzzle, counting benefits, counting hopes, telling off Dick, Nicole, her mother, the director she met yesterday, like stops on a string of beads. When Dick knocked, she had just dressed and been watching the rain, thinking of some poem, and of full gutters in Beverly Hills. When she opened the door, she saw him as something fixed and godlike, as he had always been, as older people are to younger, rigid and unmalleable. Dick saw her with an inevitable sense of disappointment. It took him a moment to respond to the unguarded sweetness of her smile, her body calculated to a millimeter to suggest a bud, yet guarantee a flower. He was conscious of the print of her wet foot on a rug through the bathroom door.
"Miss Television,"
he said with a lightness he did not feel. He put his gloves, his briefcase, on the dressing table, his stick against the wall. His chin dominated the lines of pain around his mouth, forcing them up into his forehead and the corner of his eyes, like fear that cannot be shown in public.
"Come and sit on my lap close to me," he said softly. "And let me see about your lovely mouth."
She came over and sat there, and while the dripping slowed down outside, drip, drip, she laid her lips to the beautiful cold image she had created. Presently, she kissed him several times in the mouth, her face getting big as it came up to him. He had never seen anything so dazzling as the quality of her skin. And since sometimes beauty gives back the images of one's best thoughts, he thought of his responsibility about Nicole, and of the responsibility of her being 2 doors down across the corridor.
"The rain's over," he said.
"Do You see the sun on the slate. Rosemary stood up and leaned down and said her most sincere thing to him.
Oh, we're such actors, you and I.
She went to her dresser, and the moment that she laid her comb flat against her hair, there was a slow, persistent knocking at the door. They were shocked, motionless. The knock was repeated insistently, and in the sudden realization that the door was not locked, Rosemary finished her hair with one stroke, nodded at Dick, who had quickly jerked the wrinkles out of the bed where they had been sitting, and started for the door. Dick said in quite a natural voice, not too loud, "So if you don't feel up to going out, I'll tell Nicole and we'll have a very quiet last evening." The precautions were needless, for the situation of the parties outside the door was so harassed as to preclude any but the most fleeting judgments on matters not pertinent to themselves. Standing there was Abe, aged by several months in the last 24 hours, and a very frightened, concerned colored man, whom Abe introduced as Mr. Peterson of Stockholm.
"He's in a terrible situation, and it's my fault," said Abe. "We need some good advice." "Come in our rooms," said Dick.
Abe insisted that Rosemary come too, and they crossed the hall to the diver's suite. Jules Peterson, a small, respectable Negro on the suave model that heals the Republican Party in the border states, followed. It appeared that the latter had been a legal witness to the early morning dispute in Montparnasse. He had accompanied Abe to the police station and supported his assertion that a 1,000-franc note had been seized out of his hand by a Negro, whose identification was one of the points of the case. Abe and Jules Peterson, accompanied by an agent of police, returned to the bistro and too hastily identified as the criminal a Negro, who, so it was established after an hour, had only entered the place after Abe left. The police had further complicated the situation by arresting the prominent Negro restaurateur, Freeman, who had only drifted through the alcoholic fog at a very early stage and then vanished. The true culprit, whose case, as reported by his friends, was that he had merely commandeered a 50-franc note to pay for drinks that Abe had ordered, had only recently and in a somewhat sinister role reappeared upon the scene. In brief, Abe had succeeded in the space of an hour in entangling himself with the personal lives, consciences, and emotions of one Afro-European and three Afro-Americans inhabiting the French Latin Quarter. The disentanglement was not even faintly in sight, and the day had passed in an atmosphere of unfamiliar Negro faces bobbing up in unexpected places and around unexpected corners, and insistent Negro voices on the phone. In person, Abe had succeeded in evading all of them, save Jules Peterson. Peterson was rather in the position of the friendly Indian who had helped a white. The Negroes who suffered from the betrayal were not so much after Abe as after Peterson, and Peterson was very much after what protection he might get from Abe. Up in Stockholm, Peterson had failed as a small manufacturer of shoe polish, and now possessed only his formula and sufficient trade tools to fill a small box. However, his new protector had promised in the early hours to set him up in business in Versailles. Abe's former chauffeur was a shoemaker there, and Abe had handed Peterson 200 francs on account. Rosemary listened with distaste to this rigmarole. To appreciate its grotesquerie required a more robust sense of humor than hers. The little man with his portable manufactory, his insincere eyes that, from time to time, rolled white semicircles of panic into view. The figure of Abe, his face as blurred as the gaunt fine lines of it would permit, all this was as remote from her as sickness.
"I ask only a chance in life," said Peterson with the sort of precise yet distorted intonation peculiar to colonial countries. "My methods are simple. My formula is so good that I was drove away from Stockholm, ruined, because I did not care to dispose of it."
Dick regarded him politely. Interest formed, dissolved. He turned to Abe.
You go to some hotel and go to bed. After you're all straight, Mr. Peterson will come and see you.
But don't you appreciate the mess that Peterson's in?
Abe protested.
I shall wait in the hall, said Mr. Peterson with delicacy. It is, perhaps, hard to discuss my problems in front of me.
He withdrew after a short travesty of a French bow. Abe pulled himself to his feet with the deliberation of a locomotive.
I don't seem highly popular today.
Popular, but not probable, Dick advised him.
My advice is to leave this hotel, by way of the bar, if you want. Go to the Chambord, or if you'll need a lot of service, go over to the Majestic.
Could I annoy you for a drink?
There's not a thing up here, Dick lied.
Resignedly, Abe shook hands with Rosemary. He composed his face slowly, holding her hand a long time and forming sentences that did not emerge.
You are the most... one of the most...
She was sorry, and rather revolted at his dirty hands, but she laughed in a well-bred way, as though it were nothing unusual to her to watch a man walking in a slow dream. Often people display a curious respect for a man drunk, rather like the respect of simple races for the insane. Respect rather than fear. There is something awe-inspiring in one who has lost all inhibitions, who will do anything. Of course, we make him pay afterward for his moment of superiority, his moment of impressiveness. Abe turned to Dick with a last appeal.
If I go to a hotel and get all steamed and curry-combed and sleep a while and fight off these Senegalese, could I come and spend the evening by the fireside?
Dick nodded at him, less in agreement than in mockery, and said, You have a high opinion of your current capacities.
I bet if Nicole was here, she'd let me come back.
All right. Dick went to a trunk tray and brought a box to the central table. Inside were innumerable cardboard letters.
You can come if you want to play anagrams.
Abe eyed the contents of the box with physical revulsion, as though he had been asked to eat them like oats.
What are anagrams? Haven't I had enough strange...
It's a quiet game. You spell words with them. Any word except alcohol.
I bet you can spell alcohol.
Abe plunged his hand among the counters.
Can I come back if I can spell alcohol?
You can come back if you want to play anagrams.
Abe shook his head resignedly.
If you're in that frame of mind, there's no use. I'd just be in the way.
He waved his finger reproachfully at Dick.
But remember what George III said, that if Grant was drunk, he wished he would bite the other generals.
With a last desperate glance at Rosemary from the golden corners of his eyes, he went out. To his relief, Peterson was no longer in the corridor. Feeling lost and homeless, he went back to ask Paul the name of that boat. Chapter 25. When he had tottered out, Dick and Rosemary embraced fleetingly. There was a dust of Paris over both of them through which they scented each other. The rubber guard on Dick's fountain pen, the faintest odor of warmth from Rosemary's neck and shoulders. For another half minute, Dick clung to the situation. Rosemary was first to return to reality.
I must go, youngster, she said.
They blinked at each other across a widening space, and Rosemary made an exit that she had learned young, and on which no director had ever tried to improve. She opened the door of her room and went directly to her desk, where she had suddenly remembered leaving her wristwatch. It was there. Slipping it on, she glanced down at the daily letter to her mother, finishing the last sentence in her mind. Then, rather gradually, she realized, without turning about, that she was not alone in the room. In an inhabited room, there are refracting objects only half noticed. Varnished wood, more or less polished brass, silver and ivory, and beyond these a thousand conveyors of light and shadow so mild that one scarcely thinks of them as that. The tops of picture frames, the edges of pencils or ashtrays, of crystal or china ornaments. The totality of this refraction, appealing to equally subtle reflexes of the vision as well as to those associational fragments in the subconscious that we seem to hang on to, as a glass fitter keeps the irregularly shaped pieces that may do sometime. This fact might account for what Rosemary afterward mystically described as realizing that there was someone in the room before she could determine it. But when she did realize it, she turned swift in a sort of ballet step and saw that a dead Negro was stretched upon her bed as she cried, "Ah!" And her still unfastened wristwatch banged against the desk. She had the preposterous idea that it was Abe North. Then she dashed for the door and across the hall. Dick was straightening up. He had examined the gloves worn that day and thrown them into a pile of soiled gloves in a corner of a trunk. He had hung up coat and vest and spread his shirt on another hanger, a trick of his own. "You'll wear a shirt that's a little dirty where you won't wear a must shirt." Nicole had come in and was dumping one of Abe's extraordinary ashtrays into the wastebasket when Rosemary tore into the room. "Dick! Dick! Come and see!" Dick jogged across the hall into her room. He knelt to Peterson's heart and felt the pulse. The body was warm. The face, harassed and indirect in life, was gross and bitter in death. The box of materials was held under one arm, but the shoe that dangled over the bedside was bare of polish, and its sole was worn through. By French law, Dick had no right to touch the body, but he moved the arm a little to see something. There was a stain on the green coverlet. There would be faint blood on the blanket beneath. Dick closed the door and stood thinking. He heard cautious steps in the corridor, and then Nicole calling him by name. Opening the door, he whispered, "Bring the couverture and top blanket from one of our beds. Don't let anyone see you." Then, noticing the strained look on her face, he added quickly, "Look here, you mustn't get upset over this. It's only some nigger scrap. I want it to be over." The body, as Dick lifted it, was light and ill-nourished. He held it so that further hemorrhages from the wound would flow into the man's clothes. Laying it beside the bed, he stripped off the coverlet and top blanket, and then, opening the door an inch, listened. There was a clank of dishes down the hall, followed by a loud, patronizing, "Merci, madame." But the waiter went in the other direction, toward the service stairway. Quickly, Dick and Nicole exchanged bundles across the corridor. After spreading this covering on Rosemary's bed, Dick stood, sweating in the warm twilight, considering. Certain points had become apparent to him in the moment following his examination of the body. First, that Abe's first hostile Indian had tracked the friendly Indian and discovered him in the corridor. And when the latter had taken desperate refuge in Rosemary's room, had hunted down and slain him. Second, that if the situation were allowed to develop naturally, no power on earth could keep the smear off Rosemary. The paint was scarcely dry on the Arbuckle case. Her contract was contingent upon an obligation to continue rigidly and unexceptionally as Daddy's girl. Automatically, Dick made the old motion of turning up his sleeves, though he wore a sleeveless undershirt, and bent over the body. Getting a purchase on the shoulders of the coat, he kicked open the door with his heel and dragged the body quickly into a plausible position in the corridor. He came back into Rosemary's room and smoothed back the grain of the plush floor rug. Then he went to the phone in his suite and called the manager-owner of the hotel. "Macbeth, it's Dr. Diver speaking. Something very important. Are we on a more or less private line?" It was good that he had made the extra effort which had firmly entrenched him with Mr. Macbeth. Here was one use for all the pleasingness that Dick had expended over a large area he would never retrace. "Going out of the suite, we came on a dead Negro.
In the hall. No, no. He's a civilian. Wait a minute now. I knew you didn't want any guests to blunder on the body, so I'm phoning you. Of course, I must ask you to keep my name out of it. I don't want any French red tape just because I discovered the man. What exquisite consideration for the hotel. Only because Mr. Macbeth, with his own eyes, had seen these traits in Dr. Diver 2 nights before, could he credit the story without question. In a minute, Mr. Macbeth arrived, and in another minute, he was joined by a gendarme. In the interval, he found time to whisper to Dick, "You can be sure the name of any guest will be protected. I'm only too grateful to you for your pains." Mr. Macbeth took an immediate step that may only be imagined, but that influenced the gendarme so as to make him pull his mustaches in a frenzy of uneasiness and greed. He made perfunctory notes and sent a telephone call to his post. Meanwhile, with a celerity that Jules Peterson, as a businessman, would have quite understood, the remains were carried into another apartment of one of the most fashionable hotels in the world. Dick went back to his salon.
"What happened?"
cried Rosemary.
"Do all the Americans in Paris just shoot at each other all the time?"
"This seems to be the open season," he answered. "Where's Nicole?"
"I think she's in the bathroom."
She adored him for saving her. Disasters that could have attended upon the event had passed in prophecy through her mind, and she had listened in wild worship to his strong, sure, polite voice making it all right. But before she reached him in a sway of soul and body, his attention focused on something else. He went into the bedroom and toward the bathroom. And now Rosemary, too, could hear, louder and louder, a verbal inhumanity that penetrated the keyholes and the cracks in the doors, swept into the suite, and in the shape of horror, took form again. With the idea that Nicole had fallen in the bathroom and hurt herself, Rosemary followed Dick. That was not the condition of affairs at which she stared before Dick shouldered her back and brusquely blocked her view. Nicole knelt beside the tub, swaying sidewise and sidewise. "It's you," she cried. "It's you come to intrude on the only privacy I have in the world. With your spread with red blood on it. I'll wear it for you. I'm not ashamed, though it was such a pity. On All Fool's Day, we had a party on the Zurich Zee, and all the fools were there, and I wanted to come dressed in a spread, but they wouldn't let me. Control yourself." So I sat in the bathroom, and they brought me a domino and said, "Wear that." I did. What else could I do? "Control yourself, Nicole. I never expected you to love me. It was too late. Only don't come in the bathroom, the only place I can go for privacy, dragging spreads with red blood on them and asking me to fix them. Control yourself. Get up." Rosemary, back in the salon, heard the bathroom door bang and stood trembling. Now she knew what Violet McKisco had seen in the bathroom at Villa Diana. She answered the ringing phone and almost cried with relief when she found it was Collis Clay, who had traced her to the diver's apartment. She asked him to come up while she got her hat, because she was afraid to go into her room alone. Book 2 Chapter 1 In the spring of 1917, when Dr. Richard Diver first arrived in Zurich, he was 26 years old, a fine age for a man, indeed the very acme of bachelorhood. Even in wartime days, it was a fine age for Dick, who was already too valuable, too much of a capital investment to be shot off in a gun. Years later, it seemed to him that, even in this sanctuary, he did not escape lightly. But about that, he never fully made up his mind. In 1917, he laughed at the idea, saying apologetically that the war didn't touch him at all. Instructions from his local board were that he was to complete his studies in Zurich and take a degree as he had planned.
Switzerland was an island, washed on one side by the waves of thunder around Gorizia, and on another by the cataracts along the Somme and the Aisne. For once, there seemed more intriguing strangers than sick ones in the cantons. But that had to be guessed at. The men who whispered in the little cafes of Bern and Geneva were as likely to be diamond salesmen or commercial travelers. However, no one had missed the long trains of blinded or one-legged men, or dying trunks that crossed each other between the bright lakes of Constance and Neuchâtel. In the beer halls and shop windows were bright posters presenting the Swiss defending their frontiers in 1914. With inspiring ferocity, young men and old men glared down from the mountains at phantom French and Germans. The purpose was to assure the Swiss heart that it had shared the contagious glory of those days. As the massacre continued, the posters withered away, and no country was more surprised than its sister republic when the United States bungled its way into the war. Dr. Diver had seen around the edges of the war by that time. He was an Oxford Rhodes Scholar from Connecticut in 1914. He returned home for a final year at Johns Hopkins and took his degree. In 1916, he managed to get to Vienna under the impression that, if he did not make haste, the great Freud would eventually succumb to an aeroplane bomb. Even then, Vienna was old with death. But Dick managed to get enough coal and oil to sit in his room in the Damenstiftstrasse and write the pamphlets that he later destroyed. But that, rewritten, were the backbone of the book he published in Zurich in 1920. Most of us have a favorite, a heroic period in our lives. And that was Dick Diver's. For one thing, he had no idea that he was charming, that the affection he gave and inspired was anything unusual among healthy people. In his last year at New Haven, someone referred to him as Lucky Dick. The name lingered in his head.
"Lucky Dick, you big stiff,"
he would whisper to himself, walking around the last sticks of flame in his room.
"You hit it, my boy. Nobody knew it was there before you came along."
At the beginning of 1917, when it was becoming difficult to find coal, Dick burned for fuel almost 100 textbooks that he had accumulated. But only as he laid each one on the fire, with an assurance chuckling inside him that he was himself a digest of what was within the book, that he could brief it 5 years from now, if it deserved to be briefed. This went on at any odd hour, if necessary, with a floor rug over his shoulders, with the fine quiet of the scholar which is nearest of all things to heavenly peace, but which, as will presently be told, had to end. For its temporary continuance, he thanked his body that had done the flying rings at New Haven, and now swam in the winter Danube. With Elkins, second secretary at the embassy, he shared an apartment, and there were two nice girl visitors, which was that, and not too much of it, nor too much of the embassy either. His contact with Ed Elkins aroused in him a first faint doubt as to the quality of his mental processes. He could not feel that they were profoundly different from the thinking of Elkins. Elkins, who would name you all the quarterbacks in New Haven for 30 years. And Lucky Dick can't be one of these clever men. He must be less intact, even faintly destroyed. If life won't do it for him, it's not a substitute to get a disease, or a broken heart, or an inferiority complex. Though, it'd be nice to build out some broken side till it was better than the original structure. He mocked at his reasoning, calling it specious and American. His criteria of uncerebral phrase-making was that it was American. He knew, though, that the price of his intactness was incompleteness. "The best I can wish you, my child," so said the fairy black stick in Thackeray's The Rose and the Ring, "is a little misfortune." In some moods, he griped at his own reasoning. Could I help it that Pete Livingstone sat in the locker room tap day when everybody looked all over hell for him? And I got an election when otherwise I wouldn't have got Elihu, knowing so few men. He was good and right, and I ought to have sat in the locker room instead. Maybe I would, if I thought I had a chance at an election. But Mercer kept coming to my room all those weeks. I guess I knew I had a chance all right. But it would have served me right if I'd swallowed my pin in the shower and set up a conflict. After the lectures at the university, he used to argue this point with a young Romanian intellectual, who reassured him,
"There is no evidence that Goethe ever had a conflict in the modern sense. Or a man like Jung, for instance.
You're not a romantic philosopher. You're a scientist. Memory, force, character, especially good sense. That's going to be your trouble. Judgment about yourself.
Once I knew a man who worked 2 years on the brain of an armadillo, with the idea that he would sooner or later know more about the brain of an armadillo than anyone. I kept arguing with him that he was not really pushing out the extension of the human range. It was too arbitrary. And sure enough, when he sent his work to the medical journal, they refused it. They had just accepted a thesis by another man on the same subject.
Dick got up to Zurich on less Achilles' heels than would be required to equip a centipede, but with plenty, the illusions of eternal strength and health and of the essential goodness of people, illusions of a nation, the lies of generations of frontier mothers who had to croon falsely that there were no wolves outside the cabin door. After he took his degree, he received his orders to join a neurological unit forming in Bar-sur-Aube. In France, to his disgust, the work was executive rather than practical. In compensation, he found time to complete the short textbook and assemble the material for his next venture. He returned to Zurich in the spring of 1919, discharged. The foregoing has the ring of a biography, without the satisfaction of knowing that the hero, like Grant, lolling in his general store in Galena, is ready to be called to an intricate destiny. Moreover, it is confusing to come across a youthful photograph of someone known in a rounded maturity and gaze with a shock upon a fiery, wiry, eagle-eyed stranger. Best to be reassuring. Dick Diver's moment now began. Chapter 2. It was a damp April day, with long diagonal clouds over the Albishorn and water inert in the low places. Zurich is not unlike an American city. Missing something ever since his arrival 2 days before, Dick perceived that it was the sense he had had in finite French lanes that there was nothing more. In Zurich, there was a lot besides Zurich. The roofs upled the eyes to tinkling cow pastures, which in turn modified hilltops further up, so life was a perpendicular starting off to a postcard heaven. The alpine lands, home of the toy and the funicular, the merry-go-round and the thin chime were not a being here, as in France with French vines growing over one's feet on the ground. In Salzburg, once, Dick had felt the superimposed quality of a bought-and-borrowed century of music. Once, in the laboratories of the university in Zurich, delicately poking at the cervical of a brain, he had felt like a toy maker, rather than like the tornado who had hurried through the old red buildings of Hopkins 2 years before, unstayed by the irony of the gigantic Christ in the entrance hall. Yet he had decided to remain another 2 years in Zurich, for he did not underestimate the value of toy making, in infinite precision, of infinite patience. Today he went out to see Franz Gregorovius at Daimler's clinic on the Zürichsee. Franz, resident pathologist at the clinic, a Vaudois by birth, a few years older than Dick, met him at the tram stop. He had a dark and magnificent aspect of Cagliostro about him, contrasted with holy eyes. He was the third of the Gregoroviuses. His grandfather had instructed Krepelin when psychiatry was just emerging from the darkness of all time. In personality, he was proud, fiery, and sheep-like. He fancied himself as a hypnotist. If the original genius of the family had grown a little tired, Franz would without doubt become a fine clinician. On the way to the clinic, he said,
"Tell me of your experiences in the war. Are you changed like the rest?
You have the same stupid and unaging American face. Except I know you're not stupid, Dick.
I didn't see any of the war. You must have gathered that from my letters, Franz.
That doesn't matter. We have some shell sharks who merely heard an air raid from a distance. We have a few who merely read newspapers.
It sounds like nonsense to me.
Maybe it is, Dick. But we're a rich person's clinic. We don't use the word nonsense. Frankly, did you come down to see me or to see that girl?
They looked sideways at each other. Franz smiled enigmatically.
Naturally, I saw all the first letters,
he said in his official basso.
When the change began, delicacy prevented me from opening any more. Really, it had become your case.
Then she's well, Dick demanded.
Perfectly well. I have charge of her. In fact, I have charge of the majority of the English and American patients. They call me Dr. Gregory.
Let me explain about that girl, Dick said. I only saw her one time. That's a fact. When I came out to say goodbye to you just before I went over to France, it was the first time I put on my uniform, and I felt very bogus in it. Went around saluting private soldiers and all that.
Why didn't you wear it today?
Hey, I've been discharged 3 weeks. Here's the way I happened to see that girl. When I left you, I walked down toward that building of yours on the lake to get my bicycle.
Toward the Cedars?
A wonderful night. You know, moon over that mountain, the Krenzig. I caught up with a nurse and a young girl. I didn't think the girl was a patient. I asked the nurse about tram times, and we walked along. The girl was about the prettiest thing I ever saw.
She still is.
She'd never seen an American uniform. And we talked, and I didn't think anything about it. He broke off, recognizing a familiar perspective, and then resumed. Except, Franz, I'm not as hard-boiled as you are yet. When I see a beautiful shell like that, I can't help feeling a regret about what's inside it. That was absolutely all. Till the letters began to come.
It was the best thing that could have happened to her, said Franz dramatically. A transference of the most fortuitous kind.
That's why I came down to meet you on a very busy day. I want you to come into my office and talk a long time before you see her. In fact, I sent her into Zurich to do errands.
His voice was tense with enthusiasm.
In fact, I sent her without a nurse, with a less stable patient. I'm intensely proud of this case, which I handled, with your accidental assistance.
The car had followed the shore of the Zürichsee into a fertile region of pasture farms and low hills, steepled with chalets. The sun swam out into a blue sea of sky, and suddenly it was a Swiss valley at its best. Pleasant sounds and murmurs and a good, fresh smell of health and cheer. Professor Domler's plant consisted of 3 old buildings and a pair of new ones, between a slight eminence and the shore of the lake. At its founding, 10 years before, it had been the first modern clinic for mental illness. At a casual glance, no layman would recognize it as a refuge for the broken, the incomplete, the menacing of this world. Though 2 buildings were surrounded with vine-softened walls of a deceptive height. Some men raked straw in the sunshine. Here and there, as they rode into the grounds, the car passed the white flag of a nurse waving beside a patient on a path. After conducting Dick to his office, Franz excused himself for 30 minutes. Left alone, Dick wandered about the room and tried to reconstruct Franz from the litter of his desk, from his books and the books of and by his father and grandfather, from the Swiss piety of a huge claret-colored photo of the former on the wall. There was smoke in the room. Pushing open a French window, Dick let in a cone of sunshine. Suddenly, his thoughts swung to the patient, the girl. He had received about 50 letters from her, written over a period of 8 months. The first one was apologetic, explaining that she had heard from America how girls wrote to soldiers whom they did not know. She had obtained the name and address from Dr. Gregory, and she hoped he would not mind if she sometimes sent word to wish him well, etc., etc. So far, it was easy to recognize the tone. From Daddy Longlegs and Molly Make-Believe, sprightly and sentimental epistolary collections enjoying a vogue in the States. But there the resemblance ended. The letters were divided into two classes, of which the first class, up to about the time of the armistice, was of marked pathological turn, and of which the second class, running from thence up to the present, was entirely normal, and displayed a richly maturing nature. For these latter letters, Dick had come to wait eagerly in the last dull months at Barsar Obe. Yet even from the first letters, he had pieced together more than Franz would have guessed of the story. Mon Capitaine, I thought when I saw you in your uniform you were so handsome. Then I thought, je m'en fiche, French too, and German. You thought I was pretty too, but I've had that before, and a long time I've stood it. If you come here again with that attitude base and criminal, and not even faintly what I had been taught to associate with the role of gentleman, then heaven help you. However, you seem quieter than the others. All soft, like a big cat. I have only gotten to like boys who are rather sissies. Are you a sissy? There were some somewhere. Excuse all this. It is the third letter I have written you and will send immediately or will never send. I've thought a lot about moonlight, too. And there are many witnesses I could find if I could only be out of here. They said you were a doctor. But so long as you are a cat, it is different. My head aches so. So excuse this walking there like an ordinary with a white cat will explain, I think. I can speak three languages. Four with English, and I'm sure I could be useful interpreting if you arrange such thing in France. I'm sure I could control everything with the belts all bound around everybody like it was Wednesday. It is now Saturday, and you are far away, perhaps killed. Come back to me someday, for I will be here always on this green hill. Unless they will let me write my father, whom I love dearly. Excuse this. I am not myself today. I will write when I feel better. Cheerio. Nicole Warren. Excuse all this. Captain Diver. I know introspection is not good for a highly nervous state like mine, but I would like you to know where I stand. Last year, or whenever it was, in Chicago, when I got so I couldn't speak to servants or walk in the street, I kept waiting for someone to tell me. It was the duty of someone who understood. The blind must be led. Only no one would tell me everything. They would just tell me half, and I was already too muddled to put two and two together. One man was nice. He was a French officer, and he understood. He gave me a flower and said it was plus petit et moins entendu. We were friends. Then he took it away. I grew sicker and there was no one to explain to me. They had a song about Joan of Arc that they used to sing at me, but that was just mean. It would just make me cry, for there was nothing the matter with my head then. They kept making reference to sports, too, but I didn't care by that time. So there was that day I went walking on Michigan Boulevard on and on for miles, and finally they followed me in an automobile, but I wouldn't get in. Finally they pulled me in, and there were nurses. After that time I began to realize it all, because I could feel what was happening in others. So you see how I stand, and what good can it be for me to stay here with the doctors harping constantly in the things I was here to get over? So today I have written my father to come and take me away. I am glad you are so interested in examining people and sending them back. It must be so much fun. And again, from another letter, You might pass up your next examination and write me a letter. They just sent me some phonograph records in case I should forget my lesson, and I broke them all so the nurse won't speak to me. They were in English, so that the nurses would not understand. One doctor in Chicago said I was bluffing, but what he really meant was that I was a twin six, and he had never seen one before. But I was very busy being mad then, so I didn't care what he said. When I am very busy being mad, I don't usually care what they say, not if I were a million girls. You told me that night you'd teach me to play. Well, I think love is all there is, or should be. Anyhow, I am glad your interest in examinations keeps you busy. Tout à vous, Nicole Warren. There were other letters, among whose helpless sojourns lurked darker rhythms. Dear Captain Diver, I write to you because there is no one else to whom I can turn, and it seems to me if this farcical situation is apparent to one as sick as me, it should be apparent to you. The mental trouble is all over, and besides that, I am completely broken and humiliated, if that was what they wanted. My family have shamefully neglected me. There's no use asking them for help or pity. I have had enough, and it is simply ruining my health and wasting my time pretending that what is the matter with my head is curable. Here I am in what appears to be a semi-insane asylum, all because nobody saw fit to tell me the truth about anything. If I had only known what was going on like I know now, I could have stood it, I guess, for I am pretty strong. But those who should have did not see fit to enlighten me. And now, when I know and have paid such a price for knowing, they sit there with their dogs' lives and say I should believe what I did believe. Especially one does, but I know now. I am lonesome all the time, far away from friends and family across the Atlantic. I roam all over the place in a half daze. If you could get me a position as interpreter, I know French and German like a native, fair Italian and a little Spanish, or in the Red Cross ambulance, or as a trained nurse, though I would have to train, you would prove a great blessing. And again, since you will not accept my explanation of what is the matter, you could at least explain to me what you think, because you have a kind cat's face. And not that funny look that seems to be so fashionable here. Dr. Gregory gave me a snapshot of you. Not as handsome as you are in your uniform, but younger looking. Mon Capitaine, it was fine to have your postcard. I am so glad you take such interest in disqualifying nurses. Oh, I understood your note very well indeed. Only I thought from the moment I met you that you were different. Dear Capitaine, I think one thing today and another tomorrow. That is really all that's the matter with me, except a crazy defiance and a lack of proportion. I would gladly welcome any alienist you might suggest. Here they lie in their bathtubs and sing Play in Your Own Backyard as if I had my backyard to play in, or any hope which I can find by looking either backward or forward. They tried it again in the candy store again, and I almost hit the man with the weight, but they held me. I am not going to write you anymore. I am too unstable. And then, a month with no letters. And then, suddenly, the change. I am slowly coming back to life. Today the flowers and the clouds. The war is over, and I scarcely knew there was a war. How kind you have been. You must be very wise behind your face, like a white cat. Except you don't look like that in the picture Dr. Gregory gave me. Today I went to Zurich. How strange a feeling to see a city again. Today we went to Bern. It was so nice with the clocks. Today we climbed high enough to find asphodel and edelweiss. After that, the letters were fewer, but he answered them all. There was one. I wish someone were in love with me like boys were ages ago before I was sick. I suppose it will be years, though, before I could think of anything like that. But when Dick's answer was delayed for any reason, there was a fluttering burst of worry, like a worry of a lover. Perhaps I have bored you, and afraid I have presumed, and I keep thinking at night you have been sick. In actuality, Dick was sick with the flu. When he recovered, all except the formal part of his correspondence was sacrificed to the consequent fatigue, and shortly afterward, the memory of her became overlaid by the vivid presence of a Wisconsin telephone girl at headquarters in Bar-sur-Aube. She was red-lipped like a poster, and known obscenely in the messes as the switchboard. Franz came back into his office feeling self-important. Dick thought he would probably be a fine clinician, for the sonorous or staccato cadences by which he disciplined nurse or patient came not from his nervous system, but from a tremendous and harmless vanity. His true emotions were more ordered and kept to himself.
"Now about the girl, Dick," he said.
"Of course, I want to find out about you and tell you about myself, but first, about the girl. Because I have been waiting to tell you about it so long."
He searched for and found a sheaf of papers in a filing cabinet, but after shuffling through them, he found they were in his way and put them on his desk. Instead, he told Dick the story. Chapter 3. About a year and a half before, Dr. Domler had some vague correspondence with an American gentleman living in Lausanne, a Mr. Devereux Warren, of the Warren family of Chicago. A meeting was arranged, and one day Mr. Warren arrived at the clinic with his daughter Nicole, a girl of 16. She was obviously not well, and the nurse who was with her took her to walk about the grounds while Mr. Warren had his consultation. Warren was a strikingly handsome man, looking less than 40. He was a fine American type in every way, tall, broad, well-made.
"Un homme très chic,"
as Dr. Domler described him to Franz. His large gray eyes were sun-veined from rowing on Lake Geneva, and he had that special air about him of having known the best of this world. The conversation was in German, for it developed that he had been educated at Göttingen. He was nervous and obviously very moved by his errand.
"Dr. Domler, my daughter isn't right in the head. I've had lots of specialists and nurses for her, and she's taken a couple of rest cures, but the thing has grown too big for me, and I've been strongly recommended to come to you."
"Very well," said Dr. Domler.
"Suppose you start at the beginning and tell me everything." "There isn't any beginning. At least there isn't any insanity in the family that I know of, on either side. Nicole's mother died when she was 11, and I've sort of been father and mother both to her, with the help of governesses. Father and mother both to her."
He was very moved as he said this. Dr. Domler saw that there were tears in the corners of his eyes and noticed for the first time that there was whiskey on his breath.
"As a child, she was a darling thing. Everybody was crazy about her. Everybody that came in contact with her. She was smart as a whip and happy as the day is long. She liked to read or draw or dance or play the piano, anything. I used to hear my wife say she was the only one of our children who never cried at night. I've got an older girl, too, and there was a boy that died. But Nicole was...
He broke off, and Dr. Domler helped him.
"She was a perfectly normal, bright, happy child. Perfectly."
Dr. Domler waited. Mr. Warren shook his head, blew a long sigh, glanced quickly at Dr. Domler, and then at the floor again.
"About 8 months ago, or maybe it was 6 months ago, or maybe 10, I try to figure, but I can't remember exactly where we were when she began to do funny things. Crazy things.
Her sister was the first one to say anything to me about it.
Because Nicole was always the same to me."
He added rather hastily, as if someone had accused him of being to blame. The same loving little girl. The first thing was about a valet.
Oh, yes,
said Dr. Domler, nodding his venerable head